It is the Apostle Paul, who in one brief quotation that he uses twice in his epistle, who introduces to us this Old Testament prophet, who is brief in his prophecy and narrow in terms of the time that he comes upon the scene of Old Testament history. But he said something that struck the apostle, guided by the Holy Spirit, that becomes a centerpiece in his letters to the Romans and Galatians. And that phrase is, "The just or the righteous shall live by faith." The name of this prophet is a little bit of a tongue twister. And as his name is rather unusual, so is his three chapters of prophecy. His name is Habakkuk. He was a contemporary of Jeremiah, although he did not do the extensive work that Jeremiah did. In fact, there's no indication, as you read this brief book of prophecy, that this particular prophet ever spoke either to the nation of Israel or Judah or to the nations around. What it seems to be is a record of his own solitary struggle, the struggle of his faith. And I want to share some thoughts about Habakkuk with you tonight. The first part of this book is a record of an intense conversation that Habakkuk has with God. First and second chapter. And then it closes in the second part in chapter 3 with a beautiful song that is an ode describing a vision of God that the prophet had in majestic appearance and of the victory of faith in his own life. There's one thing that is absolutely assured about our own lives, and that is we're going to experience some heartaches and some disappointments, and some things that are going to challenge our understanding of God's intentions and purposes. And that's the story that Habakkuk tells us. Habakkuk lived, probably, and prophesied. This thing occurred, this exchange with God, this concern of his occurred when on the horizon it was obvious that Babylon was moving toward Judah, moving toward Jerusalem. Most students of Habakkuk believe that it was in the reign probably of Jehoiakim. About 608 B.C. it began, after the fall of Assyria, when Nineveh was no longer a threat, and when Babylon surely was, that this conversation took place. Nahum had his total work involved with talking about the fall of Assyria. Habakkuk does not so much announce the fall of Babylon as he wrestles with the whole question of why Babylon at all. It's interesting as we're studying this tonight that in that region of the world again, that here we know as Chaldea, as Babylon, now modern Iraq, that events are taking place that are frightening, bloody, horrifying. And what I want you to do this evening is to spend a little time with this, your brother, this, an ancient servant of God, who had problems accepting what God was telling him was about to happen. He had problems accepting that. This is a godly man. And he believes in the Lord. And it's because he believes in the Lord and believes in the Lord so intently that he has problems with what God is telling him. The first section let me describe as the problem of faith. The problem of faith. He begins by saying that his burden, the burden which Habakkuk the prophet did see, some expositors have said he had a burden. Well, of course, the expression burden usually in the language of the prophets means that he was given something from God that was ordinary to be spoken to someone. This was his burden to announce, but he is not announcing it to anyone.
He's raising his question with God. He's speaking to the Lord, O Jehovah. How long shall I cry and you will not hear? I cry out to you of violence and you will not save. Why do you show me iniquity and look upon perverseness? For destruction and violence are before me, and there is strife and contention rising up. He didn't understand if God was a righteous God, how he could tolerate this kind of behavior among his own people. Habakkuk is not talking about the Chaldeans here. He's talking about Judah. He's talking about the city of Jerusalem. And what he's saying is, how can you be the God that I believe in? Pure and holy and righteous and demanding justice and looking with apparent indifference on what's going on among your people. Because you do not respond to this iniquity. Because you do not act in justice upon it, therefore the law is slack. And justice does never go forth, for the wicked compasses the righteous. Therefore justice goes forth perverted. You understand what he's saying? He's saying, because you have not been punishing iniquity, it is flourishing and getting worse. Now, I don't know if you've ever had these kinds of questions, but I'll tell you when you will have them. When you are suffering. And when things in your life are totally confused, and the events that are taking place seem to be so unjust, and your circumstances seem to be so unusually and extraordinarily burdensome, and you don't understand why God let that happen. Well, that sort of thing is certainly not happening to the wicked. They seem to be prosperous. The Lord answers the first complaint of Habakkuk in verse 5. He said, behold, among the nations, and look, and wonder and marvel, for I am working a work in your days which you will not believe. And by the way, that's a plural view. You will not believe, though it be told you. For lo, I raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation that march through the breadth of the earth to possess dwelling places that are not theirs. They are terrible and dreadful. Their judgment and their dignity proceed from themselves. Their horses also are swifter than leopards, and are more fierce than the evening wolves, and their horsemen press proudly on. Yes, their horsemen come from far. They fly as an eagle that hastes to devour. They come all of them for violence. The set of their faces is forwards, and they gather captives as the sand. In other words, they're going to succeed in everything they do. Militarily, their efforts are going to be rewarded. Absolutely. They'll not turn back whatever. And as they go, they'll gather captives like the sand on the beach. That's not exactly what Habakkuk was waiting to hear. He's complained to God about the injustice in the world, and God's answer to his complaint is, I'm going to see to that. Because I'm going to unleash upon the nation of Judah that ungodly collection of men in Babylon with Nebuchadnezzar at the head, though he's unmentioned here. Sometimes it's difficult to work in the description of the Babylonians with what we know about Nebuchadnezzar from Daniel. Every now and then he had a very conscience-stricken thought and seemed to be able to recognize that Jehovah was God. But obviously the nation of Babylon, along with the king of Babylon, was not characterized generally by compassion or gentleness or justice. As he says here, they are going to come with one intention, and that is to take what does not belong to them, and to take it by force, and they'll not be deterred. And the thing that will be discouraging is that their horses and their chariots will be swifter than any other, and their war machine will absolutely overpower everything in the front. One thing we can learn from this, and that is that just because your war machine is big, and just because it can overpower anything ahead of you, and just because you have some great success in military combat does not mean that you as a nation or as individuals are going to win anything. God just says they are proud people, they're terrible and they're dreadful. Verse 10, yes, he scoffs at kings, and princes are derision to him. That is to say, all of the kings, all of the princes mean nothing to him. They are just as a chaff on a threshing floor. He derides every stronghold, he heaps up dust and takes it. Then shall he sweep by as the wind, and shall pass over and be guilty, even he whose might is his God. You see what the problem is? The reason that Babylon will be guilty at last, the reason that God will use him then punish him, is because might is his God. If you're strong enough to do it, you do it. And the future belongs to the strong. We have a lot of people who have that philosophy. And that is that if you want to succeed in life, you have to be stronger than other people. You have to be smarter than other people. You have to be shrewder than other people. You have to be ahead of everybody. And that's how you succeed. It's a godless philosophy. And it's brutal. And sometimes we exercise this kind of philosophy in our relationship with other people that are a lot smaller cosmoses than the international battlefield. And as I said this morning, where these wars began that take place in places like along the Tigris and Saudi Arabia, they begin in the hearts of men, where pride and arrogance and ungodliness find a harbor and began to fester. And you can't have a war like that if you don't have a lot of people that are acting in an ungodly way. You can't have a war like that unless there's a lot of ungodliness involved. And so God used Babylon. He said, that's what I'm going to do. And now we've got a second complaint from Habakkuk. Are you not from everlasting? O Jehovah, my God, my Holy One, we shall not die. O Jehovah, you have ordained him for judgment. And you, O rock, hast established him for correction. You that are of pure eyes and to behold evil and that cannot look on perverseness, wherefore do you look upon them that deal treacherously and hold your peace when the wicked swallows up the man that is more righteous than he? And make men as fishes of the sea, as the creeping things that have no ruler over them. He takes up all of them with the angle. He catches them in his net and gathers them in his drag. Therefore he rejoices and is glad. Therefore he sacrifices to his net and burns incense to his drag, because by them his portion is fat and his food plenteous. Shall he therefore empty his net and spare not to slay the nations continually? Lord, if you allow Babylon to succeed in this, he will be emboldened to attempt even greater wickedness. How can you look on this and allow those who are more wicked than others to swallow them up? And he's asking the question now, how? I know my people are wicked. I've been one who's been complaining about it. But how can you use people that are even more wicked to judge them? He doesn't get an answer immediately. He says in chapter 2, I will stand upon my watch and set me upon the tower, and I will look forth to see what he will speak with me and what I shall answer concerning my complaint. Here is the answer of faith. He had the problem of faith. You see, if he hadn't believed in God and a righteous God and a just God, he wouldn't have had any problem. That's the reason that people address me and say, well, there couldn't be a God. I don't believe in God, because if there was a God, there wouldn't be all this ungodliness in the world, all this wickedness, all this pain and suffering. And my response to that is, it's because there is a God that you're complaining about the ungodliness and suffering and injustice in the world. Because if there were not a God who set such a standard in your heart, you wouldn't even be aware of injustice or ungodliness. He is the standard. And because we know the kind of God we serve, sometimes that fact makes us look at the world and wonder if he's in control. And that was Habakkuk's concern. But he had the good sense, my dear brothers and sisters, to take his complaint to God. He's not talking to somebody else. Job made a lot of mistakes, but he did not make the mistake of not taking his problem to the Lord. Now listen to the Lord's response to this second complaint in verse 2. And the Lord answered me and said, write the vision and make it plain upon tablets, that he may run that reads it. In other words, make a billboard out of it. I want this vision written so large and made so clear in language it cannot be misunderstood, so that a man running by can read it as he passes. For the vision is yet for the appointed time, and it hastes toward the end, and shall not lie. Though it tarry, wait for it, because it will surely come, it will not delay. What he's telling Habakkuk is, you're going to see these events. They may tarry for a time, but you're going to see these events. If this is about 606, 608 BC, in 606, Daniel will go into captivity. In 599, 598, Ezekiel and 10,000 captives along with King Jehoiakim, they're going to go into captivity along the Kibar down in Babylon. And in 586 and 87, Nebuchadnezzar will just raise the city and destroy the temple. I think that what God is saying to Habakkuk here is, you will see these events. This is going to happen. And then in verse 4, behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright in him, but the righteous shall live by his faith. Faith in this particular case does not mean faithfulness. It doesn't mean doing your duty. It doesn't mean holding up your end. What it means here is trust. And that is often the answer that we get from God. We don't get long explanations. Sometimes we want God to sit down with us and explain to me, Lord, how all this is going to work out. I want to see the whole picture. Tell me how this tragedy that struck me is going to be worked out, so everything's going to be all right. I'll be all right if you just explain it to me in detail, and I can see exactly how the thing's going to proceed. And he doesn't do that. He did not do that with Habakkuk. There are only two attitudes, by the way, that are possible in this life. The one was the attitude that characterized the Babylonians, characterized the Chaldeans, and that was the puffed up spirit of arrogance and pride. And the other attitude is faith. There isn't any other, there's not any other course. I know we'd love to seek out some mediating position. And I see so many people that I know in my heart feel that that's exactly who they are. They are the people who are the good people, who maybe do not do all that God expects them to do, and perhaps they're not the believers that they ought to be, but they're not wicked. They're not wicked. There's no middle ground. We choose between being proud or righteous. And if we are not righteous, given the grace of God and mercy toward us, His willingness to forgive, His willingness to set us upon our feet again after we've made a terrible mess out of things, then if we are not righteous, it's because we are proud and arrogant and stubborn, and because we will have our own way. Indeed, we can just put it down that the proud man cannot be righteous, because he cannot be faithful. He cannot trust. The only person in this world that he's willing to trust himself. And that exactly characterized the armies of Chaldea, and it characterized Nebuchadnezzar. Hasty, proud, arrogant, wicked, because by force of arms they were able to take whatever they wanted, and God did not strike them from heaven. They were succeeding. And the more they succeeded, just exactly as Habakkuk said, the more they succeed, Lord, the more boldly arrogant they'll be, and the more devastation they'll work in the world. You can't do this. This is not good. But the Lord answered. And what he tells him is, I'll take care of Babylon. I'll take care of the Chaldeans. He recognizes who they are. Verse 5, yes, moreover, wine is treacherous. A haughty man that keeps not at home, who enlarges his desire as Sheol, and he is as death and cannot be satisfied, but gathers to him all the nations and heaps to him all people. Shall not all these take up a parable against him and a taunting proverb against him and say, woe to him that increases that which is not his? How long? And that lades himself with pledges. He's talking about the Chaldeans. Getting hungry. And filling the hunger, and then getting hungrier still, as the old saw is about the farmer who said that he only, all the land he wanted was his and whatever joined it. That's all he wanted in his work. And that was Chaldea. All he wanted was what was there and whatever joined it. And so God recognized that that's exactly what's going to happen, but he said that avaricious appetite to take whatever you can get will destroy you. And it will destroy the Chaldeans until a taunt and a proverb is going to be taken up against them. Verse 7, shall they not rise up suddenly that shall bite thee, and awake that shall vex thee, and you shall be for booty to them, Because you have plundered many nations, all the remnant of the people shall plunder you because of men's blood and for the violence done to the land, to the city, and to all that dwell therein. Woe to him that gets an evil gain for his house, that he may set his nest on high, that he may be delivered from the hand of evil. You have devised shame to your house by cutting off many people and have sinned against your soul. For the stone shall cry out of the wall and the beam out of the timber shall answer it. Woe to him that builds a town with blood and establishes a city by iniquity. Behold, is it not of the Lord of hosts that the peoples labor for the fire and the nations weary themselves for vanity? For the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. I'm not sure all that's involved in that last statement. I don't believe it means that everybody's going to honor him willingly. There's no scenario that I know that's painted anywhere in the scripture that suggests that last everybody is going to yield to the will of God. But I tell you one thing, his justice and his righteousness is going to be made known to everybody. They're all going to know that he is the Lord. And that's the promise that's being made here to Habakkuk. That at last the fire that these nations have kindled by their avaricious desire to take everything in their path will burn them up as well. Justice always is done. But our problem is we want it done now. Now. We want justice this minute. I look at what sometimes amazes me is the arrogance of some figures in the Middle East. Maybe I don't understand a lot of things. But it just seems to me that here we've got some cases of egregious wickedness. Wickedness personified. And sometimes it looks like they come out smelling like a rose every time. And there is something in me that says, I want him to get it. I want him to face it now. I want to see this person destroyed. Well, that really is not my business. That's the Lord's business. And it may well be that that individual who arrogantly thrusts his fist in the face of God and does whatever he good and well pleases with other people and wreaks havoc in the world, it may well be that he'll go a long time. And of course, any time at all is a long time with a character like that before he meets his comeuppance. But what the Lord is saying here is, I'll deal with him. You trust me. You trust me. That's how the righteous are going to live. That's how the righteous are going to survive. And he's talking here not just about living spiritually, but surviving through the firestorm. With your faith and confidence and hope intact. And with your character intact. Righteous character intact. Verse 15, woe to him that gives his neighbor drink. You that add your venom and make him drunk also, that you may look on their nakedness. You are filled with shame and not glory. Drink also and be as one uncircumcised. The cup of the Lord's right hand shall come round to you and foul shame shall be upon your glory. For the violence done to Lebanon shall cover you and the destruction of the beast which made them afraid because of men's blood and for the violence done to the land, to the city and to all that dwell therein. Verse 18, what profits the graven image that the maker thereof hath graven it, the molten image, even the teacher of lies, that he that fashions its form with trust therein to make dumb idols? Woe to him that says to the wood, awake, and to the dumb stone, arise. Shall this teach? Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, and there is no breath at all in the midst of it. But the Lord is in his holy temple, that all the earth keep silence before him. These dumb idols that men serve, they cannot speak, but God can speak. And God is alive. And he is in his holy temple. And we need, with reverential awe, to close our mouths and to listen to him. The one who trusts in God, the one who lives by faith, is the one who will do this. That's a very harsh and penetrating judgment on the Chaldeans. But it didn't change his promise about the fact that that very people that he intends to judge in the future are going to come and lay waste Habakkuk's land and his people, brothers, sisters, cousins, uncles, aunts. And though it's not specifically said here, the very sanctuary of God is to be penetrated, polluted,
destroyed as a consequence of this. And that for many Jews was the end of everything. Remember what the apostles said when Jesus said, not one stone of this building will be left upon another. They thought it was the end of an age. The end of everything. And now finally, the assurance of faith. It's not the kind of assurance that we usually anticipate. The kind of assurance that we would like to have is to have everything start turning out all right. And have it start turning out all right now. I confess to you that's in many cases the thrust of my own hopes. I'm praying to God and I'm wanting things to turn out right now, but that's not how it happens. A prayer of Habakkuk gets introduced. The prophet said to Shigiono. Now, that clue is about all we know about Habakkuk. His name is never mentioned anywhere else. No personal notes are made here. We hear the story of his struggle. We can feel with him what he's struggling with. Some think he was one of the Levitical singers because of this musical notation here. But then he begins his appeal. O Lord, I have heard the report of you, and I am afraid. O Lord, revive your work in the midst of the years. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. What he's saying is, we remember the glories of God of the past. We know the glories of the deliverance of God in Egypt. We know the story of the Red Sea. We know the story of the wilderness wandering. We know the story of the great exploits and victories of David and the reign of Solomon. We know all those great stories of your glory. And we hear you saying that in the future there's going to be something wonderful happen and you're going to work everything out. But what about now? In the midst of the year. In the midst of the year. Let us know that you will care for us and that you are working for our good. In wrath, remember mercy. And then he began to describe how God came to Mount Sinai and first met with the people. And all the power that was manifest in connection with the leading of the children of Israel out of Egypt into the promised land. That's why he mentions Mount Paran, and that's why he mentions Teman. These are regions down in the Sinai Peninsula. And when you read this account, it's poetic. When he says, before him went the pestilence, and that's certainly true because he sometimes punished not only his own people through the wilderness wandering with pestilence, but also those about fiery bolts went forth at his feet, verse 5. Verse 6, he stood and measured the earth. That is to say, he's big enough to do that. He beheld and drove asunder the nations, and the eternal mountains were scattered, and the everlasting hills did bow. Well, you know that's not literal. What he's simply saying is the whole of created reality was submissive to him, and he exercised power over all the nations, and there wasn't anything moving. There wasn't anything happening that this great God did not have control over. And this description continues. Verse 11, the sun and the moon stood still in their habitation. I don't think that's referring to an event that had happened already in the case of Joshua. At the light of thine arrows as they went, at the shining of thy glittering spear, you did march through the land in indignation, you did thresh the nations in anger. You went forth for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. You wounded the head out of the house of the wicked man, laying bare the foundation even the neck. That's I remember the greatness of the past. There's a vision of his ancient greatness in this, and it seems to me also a foretelling of something yet to come. Response of Habakkuk, verse 16, I heard and my body trembled. My lips quivered at the voice. Rottenness entered into my bones, and I tremble in my place, because I must wait quietly for the day of trouble, for the coming up of the people that invades us. He understands that God is going to do what he said, and that there is going to be a judgment on Israel. There's going to be a judgment on Judah. And what can he do about it? Nothing. He said, I heard and my body trembled. I trembled in my place because I must quietly wait for this to happen. Haven't you had that experience? And something painful, exquisitely painful, that cuts you to the quick. Something that causes your heart to ache with a pain and an anguish that's almost unbearable, and all you can do is bear that.
There are no options. What are you going to do? You can't control the circumstances. Nothing Habakkuk did or said was going to change the fact that the Chaldeans were coming. Now listen to his resolve. I want you to hear the word of faith. I want you to hear the assurance of faith. This is not something that came about as a result of him being shown, led to another experience, released from the fear of this happening, because God said, I'm not going to do that then, Habakkuk. I'm not going to do what I said I was going to do. That hasn't changed at all. But listen to the attitude of the prophet. For though the fig tree shall flourish, neither shall fruit be in the vines, the labor of the olive shall fail, and the field shall yield no food. The flock shall be cut off from the fold, and there shall be no herd in the stall. Yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. The Lord God is my strength, and he will make my feet like hinds' feet, and he will make me to walk upon my high places. He just says, I will trust God. And I know at last that, as he says, the righteous will live by faith. It's a choice we make. Very quickly, as I conclude my remarks tonight, I want to look with you at some realities about our own lives. We're going to have afflictions, and we're going to have disappointments, we're going to have difficulties. They're very real, and they're not to be escaped. The Apostle Paul didn't escape them. If you read the first chapter of 2 Corinthians, he'll tell you that he was despairing of his life. He was borne down almost to total hopelessness. Almost. And sometimes the realities we have to face in our own lives can just absolutely devastate us. And they can, for the moment, cause us almost despair. This can come from the sins of other people, from our own transgressions, from circumstances that are not under our control that are hurting us. And as a consequence of that, we just feel totally borne down. There is an illustration that seems appropriate here in the writing of Philip Keller as he writes about the shepherd and the sheep, speaking of Christ. And he talks about a cast sheep in this little book. A cast sheep was one that got on his back. Did you know a sheep, when he gets on his back, can't ride himself? He can't get his feet down. So he panics and he paws the air. It sometimes happens to a sick sheep, sometimes happens to a fat sheep. But when he gets on his back, he's helpless. And what makes it worse is that gases begin to build up in the rumen inside his body. And those gases begin to cut off circulation in the limbs. On a very hot day, on a very cold day, he would die unless he gets some special help from a good shepherd. And I can tell you that's how we get sometimes. We're on our back. And we can't get our feet on the floor. And if somebody doesn't help us, we're not going to make it. And the Lord has promised that he will help us. And that we are not to go into despair. But the question we have to ask ourselves is, as we hope in God, as we put our confidence in, as we trust in him, what do we hope for? I'm afraid in too many instances what we're hoping for is, Lord, get me out of this trouble and take this trouble away. I don't want to hurt anymore. I don't want to have any pain anymore. I don't have any more difficulty. I've had enough difficulty in my life. I don't want any more. And what I'm asking for is deliverance from this. Now, I'm not suggesting to you tonight that it's wrong to pray for deliverance from pain and suffering. I don't believe it is. But I want to tell you this, that the righteous who live by faith are not people who ultimately are praying for that only. If you're trusting in God, that means you believe in his word. And you believe that he, because he is ultimately righteous, will work everything out in a righteous way. The man who trusts God, Psalm 40 verse 4 speaks of the man who trusts God. He makes God his trust. That just means he trusts that God's purposes are the greatest purposes on earth, that those are the purposes which will bless everybody, and he wants God's purposes to be worked out, however it may come about. It involves a godly character. If I trust God, it means I love him and I recognize that his way is the right way. And the need to be like him is imperative to one who trusts God. Psalm 71:5 says, you are my hope. But the question is, hope for what? Look at Psalm 73 with me. You remember this one. We were reading this just the other night over at Jim Wilson's house as we were studying the Psalms. The agony of Asaph, the Levitical singer, when he suffers being righteous and sees the wicked in prosperity,
And he says, I have washed my hands in innocence for nothing. And he says in verse 21, for my soul was grieved, and I was pricked in my heart. He's like Habakkuk. He said, Lord, how can you let these ungodly people have all the good stuff? And people that are trying to serve you have all the difficult times. How can you do that? And now he describes what his attitude was. He said, my soul was grieved and I was pricked in my heart. So brutish was I and ignorant. I was as a beast before you. Nevertheless, I am continually with thee. You have hold on my right hand. You will guide me with your counsel and afterward receive me to glory. Whom have I in heaven but you? And there's none upon earth that I desire beside you. My flesh and my heart fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. For lo, they that are far from thee shall perish. Thou hast destroyed all them that play the harlot at departing from thee, but it is good for me to draw near to God. I have made the Lord God my refuge, that I may tell all thy works. That was a decision he made. Circumstances hadn't changed. Wicked people still out there having a good time, and he's still having a tough time. But he made up his mind he was going to trust the Lord. He saw their latter end. So what is it that you have a hope for? What do you want God to guide you to? You want him to guide you to prosperous times? Good health that has no exception? When you draw near to the Lord, why do you draw near to him? For your body? To escape emotional pain of every kind? Or do you draw near to him because of your soul's existence? Do you draw near to him because of your spiritual need? And can you look and see the end of things as this man did? He said, I saw the end. Where did he get this insight? Well, he said, he came into the sanctuary of God. Of course, he's talking about the temple in this case. Verse 17. What I'm talking about tonight, putting it in contemporary terms, is listening to what God has to say and remembering that he is God and he is righteous and just, and because of what we know about him, that he sent his son to the cross. What we know about him, that he sent his son to the cross, says that he will never abandon us. He will never do it. And even if I can't figure out why things are happening the way they're happening, and likely there are going to be many instances like that, he will never abandon us. His investment is too profound. His care for us too great. And that's what he said. He said, I found out in God's house that I want that final, ultimate, real reward. I want that for myself. I want to be at peace at last with God, however difficult the road that leads me to it. Well, if we don't have that attitude, our suffering will never bless us, because it'll be an occasion for complaint and bitterness and maybe even despair. How do I want to tell you that sometimes suffering does bring momentary despair? Paul said that in first chapter of 2 Corinthians, but I want you to notice this in 2 Corinthians 4, and we'll read this and conclude the lesson. 2 Corinthians 4, verse 7. But we have this treasure in earthen vessels. He was speaking about himself. He was a clay pot. That the exceeding greatness of the power might be of God and not from ourselves. We are pressed on every side. Remember, he wrote by the Holy Spirit. That's the way it was. We are pressed on every side. You ever been like that? Pressed on every side. There was no direction you could look for escape. We are pressed on every side, yet not straightened. Perplexed. What does that mean? It means I don't understand. The Apostle Paul, perplexed, he said it. Perplexed, I don't understand why these things are happening. Habakkuk didn't understand. Job didn't understand. Many of God's people through the years have not understood. And you're perhaps sitting in this audience tonight not understanding why it's happening this way at all. Not understanding. Perplexed. How can this be something that's going to work out for good? The Apostle Paul said, he was perplexed too. Yet not unto despair. Pursued. He must have felt like a rabbit before the hound sometimes.
in every city. Somebody waiting to do him in that coterie of Jewish zealots who hated him as a turncoat. And if it was not them, it was his own brethren who were intent somehow on raising up affliction. Even when he was in prison at last in Rome, there were some people trying to create misery for him in his bonds. But he says, pursued, yet not forsaken. Smitten down. You ever been smitten down? Been lower than a snake's belly, as they say? He said, I'm beat down, but I'm not destroyed. Always bearing about in the body the dying of Jesus, that the life also of Jesus may be manifest in our body. I think that's a revealing paragraph. It's not to be expected that we're not going to ever have an experience like Habakkuk and feel like things are not working out right. This can't be right. Lord, surely not this. When the answer that comes is that we have to trust Him. That He will take care of it. Through the pain and through the disappointment, through the heartache. And learning to do it in the midst of so many signs that everything is going the wrong way is the strengthening of faith. The righteous live by faith. Habakkuk learned it a long time ago. You and I are still learning. We're still learning the lesson. Let's be good students. And realize that if sometimes we are beaten down, we can never be destroyed. And if sometimes we are perplexed, it'll never be to despair. Because we believe that Jehovah reigns in the universe. And that all things are going to be worked out according to the counsel of His will. And as Habakkuk said, He does everything for His people. For His people. For the salvation of His people. You're one of His people tonight. He's working to accomplish that. And He's not going to leave. He may let you go through some painful times like He did Habakkuk, but He's not going to abandon you. But if you're not His child tonight, you don't have any hope at all. If you're beaten down and perplexed or pursued, I can't offer you any kind of comfort. The Bible doesn't offer you any. It just offers you an invitation to come and accept the comfort of God and the consolation of God by becoming His child. And it's done by faith. You want to be righteous, you need to believe. Quit trusting in yourself and start trusting in Him and accepting His counsel in your life. Knowing that He loves and cares for you and proven that at the cross. If you're not a child of God, young or old, in this assembly, that never confessed Jesus as Lord, never yielded your will to Him, and said, I am yours. I will serve you, and I will be your man, I'll be your woman, I'll be what you want me to be from this day forth. Then you need to do that tonight. And He invites you to do that. And we invite you while we're standing in the sanctuary.